Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Talk about the economy long enough and two things are going to come up in conversation. Those mortgage-backed securities and how we still can't figure out what they're worth. And then the mortgages themselves, how to fix the underlying problem in real estate. Not that they've got any answers necessarily, but the White House said today we'll hear the president's plan for housing next week. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. American Public Media presents Repossessing Virtue, fresh thinking on the moral, spiritual, and ethical aspects of the economic downturn. Gain perspective at speakingoffaith.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Glad you could be here on this Friday. Today is the 13th of February. Robert Gibbs, he's the president's press secretary, is doing his best to manage the news on the administration's mortgage plan. Gibbs said today, and here I quote, "Don't set an unreasonable series of expectations based on leaks from God only knows where." It'd be pretty tough to have unreasonable expectations, seeing as how it's been the better part of 2 years now since housing collapsed and nobody's come up with the answer yet. To help us figure out what the president's plan might look like, we've called Chris Mayer. He's a professor of real estate at Columbia University. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kai.
Not that we really need it, but refresh our memories as to how bad the housing market is. Is it worse than it was 18 months ago, about the same?
Well, we've seen house prices fall more than 20% in the last 18 months, and unfortunately, things are getting worse, not better.
All right, so the White House came out today and said that next Wednesday, the president is going to announce his mortgage and foreclosure relief plan in a speech in Arizona. What do you suspect that might look like?
Well, I think we're going to certainly see some significant help to deal with the foreclosure problem. And I think they've talked about providing some payments to people who are facing foreclosure and trying to create a standardized process to do this, both of which are helpful. I think, unfortunately, without legislation, there are going to be some additional barriers that they're going to need, and I think they may also call for Congress to help. One proposal that I've put forward that was actually cut from the stimulus bill, but I think will eventually come back, is one that gets rid of any restrictions on foreclosures for servicers and provides a safe harbor for them to modify mortgages.
This is all a little bit hypothetical because we won't know what the president says till next Wednesday. But let me get you on the record here about some details that are sort of starting to emerge, some rumors. One, that government might subsidize some losses on the part of lenders if there's some kind of deal worked out. What do you think?
I guess I'd really want to know a lot more details about that. How to decide who to subsidize under what circumstances, I think, is a very difficult thing. And I, you know, frankly, that wouldn't be my preferred solution to the problem. I think we ought to instead try and encourage lenders to make good decisions, and we should really be providing the credit on the homeowner side.
None of those things are easy to do, right? Because you have to figure otherwise we'd have done it already.
That's correct. You know, part of it is that I think people haven't really understood what the problem is, and they haven't been willing to take the hard steps, and that's changed. The banks are doing their part. It's really the servicers of these privately securitized mortgages, which are only 15% of the mortgages outstanding, but more than half of the defaults. Those are the ones that are the problem, and it's become clear that existing measures haven't worked, and we need much stronger action.
When all is said and done, Chris, a year into this recession and 18 months, 2 years into the housing collapse, do you think that fixing real estate is still the key to turning this whole thing around?
I think it's clear that fixing real estate is the key to turning this around. just imagine the pain we've gone through with house prices having fallen close to 25% so far. A recent Morgan Stanley report predicts another equal decline. Just imagine we're going to lose our banks completely. We're going to have almost no private lenders. We're going to have many millions of people not making their mortgage payments. I don't see how we emerge from this crisis without putting a floor on the housing market. I think that was obvious to me a year ago. It's really become clear today, given the correction that's now happened.
Chris Mayer is a professor of real estate at the Graduate School of Business at Columbia University. Chris, thanks a lot.
Sure. Thanks a lot, Kai.
The congressional speed walk through the stimulus bill continues. The House approved the plan today. The Senate is voting tonight. Washington is shoveling $787 billion into the economy. It's trying to do it quickly and with a minimum of waste, of course. But are those two things mutually exclusive? From Washington Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
To get the money out the door as quickly as possible, Congress is requiring governors to allocate some of their stimulus dollars within 45 days. That's a tall order. Neither state nor federal government agencies are designed for speed. States say they do have some projects that are ready to go. Karen Harbert says there is a way to speed things up for not-so-ready projects. Harbert is a former senior Energy Department official, now lobbying for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
The federal process, the state process are going to have to come together and find ways to streamline these projects through the very complicated and cumbersome regulatory process.
But Steve Ellis of Taxpayers for Common Sense says there is a place for government regulation. It can weed out waste. Which brings us to the second half of the stimulus spending equation. Can overburdened government agencies spend the money quickly and well?
These agencies are going to be strapped to try to move the money out quickly and efficiently. And in a lot of cases, it isn't going to happen.
But economist Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research says it has to happen. He says the whole point of the stimulus package is to spend the money, even if there is a little waste.
Not spending the money in a certain sense would be more wasteful than spending it on something bad, because we're going to end up with just a higher unemployment rate.
Congress is concerned about accountability. Lawmakers have budgeted extra money for federal agencies' inspector generals. They're the taxpayers' watchdogs. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
According to the Los Angeles Times this morning, California officials are expecting about $26 billion in stimulus spending to come their way. It's still not going to be enough to fix a whopping budget deficit in a state government that is gridlocked even on a good day. And it's not going to make it any easier to do business out here either. The high cost of running a company in the Golden State has been driving firms away for a while now. And now, other western states are trying to capitalize. From KQED, Rob Schmitz reports.
Tomorrow, 400 of California's top CEOs at companies from Google to Amgen will receive Valentines from the state of Colorado. This morning, an airplane circled over L.A. with a banner proclaiming, "Colorado loves California." It's all part of a $100,000 campaign to court heartbroken businesses looking for a better suitor. Tom Clark is with the Metro Denver Economic Development Corporation.
We're not going into to steal companies. We're going in and offering an option for folks who have cost issues or they need to get into a new market. Because if we lose California, the entire West gets hurt.
Last year, $1 billion worth of venture capital flowed into Colorado, half of it from California. The state of Nevada has spent millions to lure businesses across its border. Nevada Development Authority Summer Hollingsworth says he's heard from quite a few California CEOs lately.
People have finally said, I can't be here. No matter what happens, I'm going to be sunk. So maybe I need to get out of Dodge.
And it's not just businesses looking for a way out. Public relations manager Heather Clisby recently moved to Denver from San Francisco, initially for a boy. A week later, the relationship was over.
Well, once I stopped crying, I looked up, I'm like, ooh, mountains. And I don't want to say anything bad about California, but I also felt like it was just getting really, lifestyle-wise, it was just getting very crowded.
And expensive. Now she's got her own business, and she's saving money. And she's so over her fling with the debt-ridden Golden State. In Los Angeles, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
There was a glimmer of hope around lunchtime today at the corner of Wall Street and Broad, but traders couldn't quite hold on. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The twice-a-year ritual of high style known as Fashion Week starts today in New York City. That means lots of parties and impossibly tall women strutting down catwalks. Buyers will be on the lookout for new trends, hemlines or colors or fabrics, anything to give the recession-wary a reason to shop. One new fashion phenomenon is already apparent, though, and it's only available in one size, small. Sally Herships reports.
Marlene Wallach's office walls are covered in cute faces. Blonde heads with blue eyes, brown-skinned beauties with white teeth. Her desk is stacked with pictures of hundreds more, and they're all available for work. Wallach is president of Wilhelmina Kids, the New York modeling agency and star maker for pint-sized models.
How old is she?
She's six.
She's talking about one of her clients, Ariel Binns, a first grader who looks a lot like Sasha Obama. Binns recently appeared in Harper's Bazaar in a takeoff on the classic photo of John Kennedy Jr. playing under JFK's desk in the Oval Office. Binns stands in for 8-year-old Sasha. She's the one under the desk. Former supermodel Tyra Banks takes on the role of Michelle. There's a President Obama impersonator, too. Wallach says she's been getting requests from models that look like the first daughter since Election Day.
I mean, this is off the charts, really. From zero for lookalikes of the Obama girls to, you know, we can get one a week, which is really a lot.
But that's nothing compared to the hundreds of photos pouring in from young African-American girls who want to pose in magazines, catalogs, and TV commercials as the first daughters.
People think we're running an Obama lookalike contest here.
Mark Karimzada is an editor at Women's Wear Daily. He says the Obamas have become the poster family for, well, family, not to mention hope and change. Karimzada says advertisers want to cash in on their mass appeal.
Throughout the first few weeks after the election, we've seen this real brand Obama emerge. They're young, they're handsome, they have two beautiful young daughters, and I think there's something very appealing about the notion of this healthy, happy family in the White House.
At Elite, another big New York modeling agency, they've just booked African-American beauty Veronica Webb and her two daughters for a commercial for a major retailer. The inspiration? Michelle and the girls. Neil Hamill is Elite's director. He's hoping all the Obama mania will inspire something more than imitation, shopping. He says every aspect of the fashion business is hurting, modeling included.
It's a storm. It's a big, bad, awful, horrible, scary storm. Magazine ad sales are down. Magazine circulation is down. There's just less business, period.
The fashion industry, like any other industry, is looking for a bit of a stimulus package, and the Obamas might just be the kind of inspiration that we are looking for.
That's Women's Wear Daily Mark Karimzada again. He says traditionally, first ladies have packed the most fashion punch. But this time, the kids are icons too. And they could mean more to retail than their mother. Kids don't stop growing just because the economy does. They need new things.
There's an element of fantasy as well. You know, these young girls move from Chicago to the White House. It's really a fairy tale story for a lot of people.
Child models like Ariel Binns may already be living the dream. America's Next Top Model, make way for 6-year-olds. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Sometimes on a Friday, you really have to scratch your head to remember what the big news of the week was. Granted, that hasn't really happened much since Wall Street started its free fall, and this week is no different. To help us wrap up the week on Wall Street and beyond, we've got Heidi Moore with us again from the WallStreetJournal.com. Megan McArdle from the Atlantic Magazine is here too. Hi, guys.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Megan, I'm going to start with you, actually, and I want to go back a couple of days to those hearings on Capitol Hill, the bank CEOs in front of the House Financial Services Committee getting, it can be fairly said, grilled. Did we, the taxpayers, and in some measure the owners of some of these banks, learn anything?
I thought those hearings were terrible. I mean, in part because none of the people who were grilling the bank chiefs seemed to know as much about banking as, say, your average mid-level mortgage broker.
Heidi, did you see these things the same way as Megan did?
Yeah, absolutely. It was an absolute farce. And I think truly chilling how little the House Financial Services Committee, which is, you know, technically paid to be in charge or oversee our nation's banks, not only didn't know the business lines of many of these banks, couldn't identify the CEOs, but also just asked questions that were so finance 101 that it was embarrassing. They should have done so much preparation beforehand, and it just ended up being a bloated 7-hour waste of time.
As long as we're talking about the TARP, though, the bank bailout plan, which is what they were nominally there to talk about, Heidi, what do you think of Treasury Secretary Geithner's plan that came out earlier this week?
Treasury Secretary Geithner had something in his head that he wanted to do. But again, it wasn't something that was communicated very well to people. And I think the announcement of it, that very sloppy announcement, and the delays from Friday to Monday to Tuesday really took a toll on any credibility that the plan might have. And also the way that it came out, that they would spend all this time on a stimulus plan and not really run it by Wall Street or anyone else to get a firm enough plan. They basically just announced, we're going to sell assets. We want to do it with the private sector. Discuss.
All right. Well, Megan, discuss. I mean, what do you think?
I agree with Heidi. It's not a plan. It's a plan to have a plan at some indefinite point in the future. And given that Geithner's known that this was coming for months, it's not as if Paulson at least had the excuse that it was a surprise.
All right. Well, let me ask you this then. What would you have had him do?
We're in a solvency crisis. And the uncertainty in the markets is making the problem worse. And I think it is time to bite the bullet and say, look, we are going to go in, we are going to divide banks into three groups, the banks that have limited exposure to these kinds of assets, the banks that have so much exposure that they can't be saved, and we're going to, you know, shut them down, liquidate them, and sell off their assets, and then a middle class where we're going to be working with the banks to restructure and get their balance sheets back in order. And they haven't really said that yet. They don't want to admit, A, how much it's going to cost, and B, how difficult a transition period there is going to be to get the banking system back to health.
Right, exactly. And Heidi, talk to me about the political complexity of all that, because none of that will be anything near simple.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the things that sort of crossed my mind as I was watching that horror of a congressional hearing was that this is why other countries hate America. Right. It's not because we use our power. It is because we misuse our power. And we have squandered this chance to educate ourselves, to deal with this in a nuanced way, and take the time to find a solution that works for everybody. And so, you know, I think that what Megan said is right. We need some sort of tiered solution that really brings everyone and their knowledge to the table, right? So the core problem here is these toxic assets and how to value them. And everyone is dancing around that issue and trying to find a million ways that they don't have to deal with it. But really what has to happen is that these toxic assets have to be dragged out, flogged, found out how much they're worth, and then dealt with. And that's the only thing that will give people confidence that you're not going to have more trouble in the future.
As a lot of people are starting to point out, if you don't fix the banking system, the stimulus is just not going to go very far. Without a functioning financial system, monetary velocity simply will not move fast enough to make the stimulus effective.
Megan McArdle edits the Atlantic's Business Channel. Heidi Moore blogs at Deal Journal at thewallstreetjournal.com. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up, let's call it the law of price and demand.
It's according to the power of your pocket. If the power of your pocket is less, then you purchase the things of the lesser price.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials fell more than 1% today, 82.7850 for the blue chips at the bell. The NASDAQ lost about a half a percent, 7 points, finished at 1534. The S&P 500 slipped 1%, 8 points, ended the day at 826. For the week, the Dow lost 5.25%. The Nasdaq fell 3.2%. The S&P 500 slid 4.8%. Bank stocks fell today. Citigroup and J.P. Morgan announced a plan to halt foreclosures. Citi dropped 3.33%. Both Bank of America and J.P. Morgan fell more than 5% today. PepsiCo popped up more than 1%. That after it released results in line with expectations. Abercrombie and Fitch beat estimates and rose 10%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.89%. And you're listening to Market Place.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplace's After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. It's President's Day. The stock market is closed. Party at the First President's House. Festivities take place at George Washington's Mount Vernon Estate and Gardens on the 277th anniversary of his birth date. And on February 16, 1968, the nation's first 911 emergency telephone service was implemented in Haleyville, Alabama. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As you might have heard, the consumer part of this economy isn't the healthiest place right now. As a result, there's a general tendency to be getting out of the business of running retail stores, not into them, unless you're Microsoft. There is word out of Redmond, Washington, that the software maker is planning to roll out a chain of actual brick-and-mortar stores to gin up some product buzz and better connect with its customers. From the entrepreneurship desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports that is something Microsoft has been trying to do for a while now, not with much success, though.
When you hear Microsoft Store, you instantly think Apple Store. Brian Cooley is editor-at-large for CNET. He says one key reason Apple's been so successful, it's showing off a unified line of cool products, Macs, iPhones, iPods, that it can hype, stock, and sell in a single trendy location. Cooley says Microsoft, by contrast, has a huge grab bag of products on its own and other people's machines.
Will they really have a thorough display of everything from Gateway, HP, Dell, all the accessories for the Zune, of course the Zune, the games that are on the Xbox, it can get pretty exhaustive. They'll need to have a chain of stores the size of Best Buy.
And a big box store with everything on display in rows is not what'll create a peak consumer experience and take Microsoft's branding image to a new level. Mark Gobay runs Emotional Branding. He wonders whether Microsoft can break out of its own straitjacket in a storefront.
And so what I'm worrying about is which image is coming through. Is it going to be the geek image that everyone associates with Microsoft?
CNET's Brian Cooley says shaking that image will be tough.
I get nervous whenever I think of Microsoft trying to be cool. I mean, I would let almost anybody from Apple pick out my clothes for the day. I don't think I'd let anyone from Microsoft do that.
Microsoft wants to remind you through its forthcoming stores that you can get your whole tech wardrobe through them. Games, media players, major label PCs, and all the software inside. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Chinese President Hu Jintao is on a four-day tour of Africa this week. The trip is one more indication of Beijing's growing influence and interest in the continent. Tomorrow, we'll find him in Tanzania. China is a top importer of that country's timber. And Chinese factories, in turn, export many of the counterfeit goods that are circulating in Tanzania, knockoffs of everything from high-end fashions to electronics. The prices, of course, are cheap, but the long-term economic costs can be high, as Marketplace's Gretchen Wilson explains.
This is the busiest market in Dar es Salaam. Traders from all over Africa come to this port city to buy cheap imports that they then resell across the continent. They load trucks with huge bags of jeans and purses, all bearing brand names like Chanel and Gucci. These are ostensibly Sony radios, but the labels are glued on crooked. On some, Sony is spelled with two N's, And shop owner Rogers Naftar won't give any guarantees.
These are sold as is. If it breaks, find someone to repair it, or come back and buy a new one.
Tanzania has an international reputation as a dumping ground for fake merchandise, most of it made in China. As much as 20% of goods in the country are cheap lookalikes. And what's happening here tells a bigger story of counterfeiters making a quick buck off the world's poor and the difficulty in the developing world to shut them down.
The police don't bother us. This is the Tanzanian system. Even the police themselves come here to buy fake products.
Most Tanzanians earn only a few $100s a year. Shopper Hamadi Bin Kamaro says everyone knows these cell phones and TVs don't last, but they're all most people can afford.
It's according to the power of your pocket. If the power of your pocket is less, then you purchase the things of the lesser price.
But this isn't just about cheaper prices for consumers. Local businesses can't compete. One industry group says counterfeit goods translate into the loss of 140,000 local jobs. And there are serious public health concerns. A recent crackdown found all sorts of counterfeit pharmaceuticals in Tanzania's markets, including AIDS medications and anti-malarial drugs. These are worthless pills that are made to look exactly like the real thing in order to fool pharmacists and unwitting consumers. In Dar es Salaam, one pharmacist who gives only his first name, Rommel, tells me on tape that he's confident in the quality of his medicines.
And I have to trust my suppliers. Suppliers who have passed through the proper channels. Those are the people that we deal with.
But when Rommel is sure I've stopped recording, he tells me something else. He says he knows 10% of the drugs in his pharmacy are probably fake, but that he's not about to shut down 90% of his business because of it. Most counterfeit goods come into the country through seaports, like this one in Dar es Salaam. They're usually shipped alongside legitimate products, which makes them harder to identify. A new law gives authorities more power to search private businesses and destroy fake merchandise. It also makes it easier to slap big fines on offenders. In Dar es Salaam, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at Putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
I happen to be on Twitter.
This final note today, just about now, the paramilitary security firm formerly known as Blackwater has changed its name. The company is trying to move past an incident in Baghdad 18 months ago that left at least a dozen Iraqi civilians dead. It also left Blackwater without a permit to operate there, without a State Department security contract either, hence the rebranding. Effective immediately, it's to be known as Z. That's spelled X-E, which, if I remember my high school chemistry right, is the symbol for the noble gas xenon. Colorless, odorless, just, I guess, like the company wants to be. And with that, we send you into your weekend. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped more than 1%, 82 points, 7,850. The NASDAQ lost roughly a half percent, 7 points, finished at 1534. The S&P 500 slipped 1%, 8 points, ended the day at 826. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste West, and the executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Coming up on Monday, how Web 2.0 is helping some unlucky workers.
I happened to be on Twitter at the time. I said, hey, it looks like I'm getting laid off. Immediately, people started looking for ways to help me.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.